listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Amy Bender's new novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, opens on the eve of Rose Edelstein's 9th birthday, when Rose bites into her mother's homemade lemon chocolate cake and discovers she has a magical gift. She can taste her mother's emotions in the cake. This could be a problem. What both of these openings tell us is that these are two wildly imaginative novelists. I mean, who knows? Tonight's program might veer into Lady Gaga sing-alongs, spontaneous human combustion, 4 minutes perhaps of clog dancing, and there has been talk of jam-making, Greco-Roman wrestling, and possibly a human pyramid. So, but for sure, we'll start with some readings. Both of our authors will read, and then we'll move into a conversation between Amy and Glenn, and then we'll open up to questions from you. Please wait until we bring a microphone to you, as we do record for podcast. For those of you unfamiliar with tonight's authors, and I'm sure most of you are already quite acquainted with her work, here's a tad of information. Amy Bender is the author of 3 previous books, The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, An Invisible Sign of My Own, and Willful Creatures. She teaches creative writing at USC. I said it was just a smidgen of information. Glenn David Gould's first novel, Carter Beats the Devil, has been translated into 14 languages, and his short stories and essays have appeared in McSweeney's, Playboy, and the New York Times Magazine. He used to live in Southern California, but we've lost him to that foggy city on the bay. Please welcome Amy Bender and Glenn David Gould.
Howdy. I hope it's not a letdown that there won't be any jam making tonight. No, I was. That was part of a memo. Louise had asked us what we were going to do, and I was like, you know, human pyramid, ambient buffet, things like that. But no, I'm just going to read to you. But before we get to that, I just want to mention that I'm wearing a hat tonight because Amy Bender said if I didn't wear a hat, she was going to trash the joint. And I just wanted to keep you from going berserk for a moment there. I mean, that's okay. Good. She seems pretty calm, which is good. Okay. I'm going to read to you for about 10 minutes from the beginning of my novel, Sunnyside. And here we go. At its northernmost limit, the California coastline suffered a winter of brutal winds pitched against ironclad fog and roiling seas whose whiplash could scar a man's cheek as quickly as a cat of nine tails. Since the gold rush, mariners had run aground, and those who survived the splintering impact were often pulped when the tides tore them across the terrible strata of the volcanic landscape. For protection, the state had erected a score of lighthouses staffed with teams of 3 or 4 families who rotated duties that lasted into the day and into the night. The changing of the guard, as it were, was especially treacherous in some locations, such as Crescent City, accessible only by Tombolo, that was flooded in high tide, or Point Bonita, whose wooden walkway tended to faint dead away even after the mildest storm and tear away from the loose soil of its mountainside and tumble into the sea. Until the advent of navigational radio, communication with the mainland was spotty. God help the man who broke his leg on the Farallon Islands between weekly supply ship visits. But the peril of the European war meant Crosley crystal receiver radio sets and quenched spark systems with 800-mile range for all who lived and worked on the coastline. And so, on Sunday, November 12th, 1916, just below the Oregon border, at the St. George Reef Lighthouse, 8 miles off the California coast, there began an explosion of radio, telephone, and telegraph operations unprecedented in American history. At high tide, roughly 5 o'clock in the morning, it was over an hour before dawn. The sweeping 80,000 candle power light from the third order lens cast the frothing sea from shore to the horizon into the high contrast of black against white for some moments, and then back into full pitch darkness. 2 strong men in caps and slickers rowed the station boat toward the crown of stone upon which the lighthouse stood. Their passenger, her corpulent form bundled beneath a treated canvas sail, her arms crossed around her morning thermos of coffee, was the second assistant keeper, Emily Wheeler. As the light rotated, there was a stroboscopic effect which illuminated her progress across the sea that lay like frosting above the crags and crevices of the ancient reef. Emily Wheeler, the third generation of a California family of lighthouse keepers, was a difficult woman. But as with all difficult women who could demand such isolated work, her desire was immediately granted. Of course, send her to a rock miles off the coastline. Go with the governor's blessings. But unlike other such women, she had thought to make her own uniform. She wore it under the sail and her layers of slickers and inflatable vests. It was navy wool with simple gold braid at the throat, and there was a smart matching cap under which she tucked the foundry steel braid of her hair. After considerable thought about stripes, she didn't want to seem conceited, but she also wanted to acknowledge her duties. She gave herself the rank sergeant. Her lighthouse was the world's most expensive, 9 years in the making, a cylindrical housing hewn from living granite, a 115-foot caisson tower as sturdy as a medieval fortress, its imposing skin interrupted only by the balustraic slits of loophole windows. And at the very top, capped with iron painted a brilliant red, was its lantern room, in which rotated the Fresnel lens, as faceted as a sultana's engagement diamond, and which, like the Eye of Argus, was chambered myriad ways, as close to omniscience as technology could dare. There was no better light in America. To be the sergeant sharing charge of such a great beast was an honor and a responsibility to which Emily Wheeler was equal. To be a woman superior to men was a life she made no secret of enjoying. In fact, to gain their confidence, she was known to pander to their prejudices, in effect putting her own gender up for sale. "Gentlemen," she said on the first day, "I do not give the orders. The sea gives the orders, and we are at the mercy of her unpredictable ways." She was clear-headed in a crisis and had organized the rescue of many a wayward sailor. However, it was her habit in the boring hours to engineer small crises herself. A twitching filament on the reserve lantern was occasion for much shouting. Cleaning the fog signal's air compressor meant at least three separate fits of panic. It was thus the curse of her men to wish on every shift for an actual disaster. Since no one could live comfortably at the station for more than a week, the four keeper families passed much of their lives in cottage-style duplexes on the coast, on the dunes just above the shoreline. Husbands and wives were eternally, twice a day, with the waxing and waning tides, handing off hot meals and kissing each other goodbye. 8 miles from shore, the station boat now settled into place on the leeward side of the lighthouse, which made a wedge-shaped windscreen, a small pool of calm. The men in the boat flashed their tiny lantern, and in response, there was a groan from the crane housing overhead, and a winch dropped down a cargo net into which Sergeant Wheeler stepped. Another exchange of lights, and then the crane withdrew, bringing her aloft. It was during the long moments when she swung in the wind and the spray of the sea managed to slap at her face and neck that she most enjoyed her job at the very edge of the map. "I am the westernmost woman in the country," she thought. Leland, her assistant, helped unbuckle her harness and step out of the cargo net. "We have a problem, Mom." Leland was always on duty at the same time she was, less a personal choice than a request of the other families. He was 24 years old, talk at the lighthouse had deemed him unfairly handsome, and he had wrecked two surreys on the dunes near the cottages while impressing girls. "What's wrong, Leland?" "Craft adrift, about a mile north-northwest. "Anyone on it?" Leland hesitated. He was generally quick with a quip, which melted Emily's heart too much and prevented any actual discipline from occurring. So now she looked at him not just as a sergeant, but as a worried mother. Finally, he said, "You should come see." They passed through the portico into the engine room and took the elevator to the cramped observation chamber just below the lantern room. There were two men already present, a father and son of the Field family, pushing each other away from their only telescope worth a damn, the Alvin Clark with the 2-inch lens. While Emily removed her slicker and polished the wet from the glasses, two more assistants came into the room. "Where's the craft?" Emily said. "It's 10 o'clock, a mile out." "And it's manned?" The assistants looked to each other, who looked to the Field family, who looked to Leland, who nodded. "Is it the invasion?" For this had been a topic of discussion of late, a grim certainty. "No, it's just one man alone." Frowning, Emily pulled the phone from the wall and called to the lantern room, asking them to fix the lens so that it shone at 10 o'clock, to send up the code flags, prepare for a series of two flag signals, notify all surrounding vessels via radio telephony that a rescue was in progress. "Lord, it's just a skiff, an open skiff," Emily whispered. She made fluttering gestures to push back the group around the Alvin Clark as they exchanged glances of anticipation, for this was either an actual crisis or one about to be shouted into existence. Emily applied her eye to the eyepiece, blinked, ran her fingers along the reeded focus knob, making a blur, and then, in a perfectly circular iris, she saw, with a clarity that made her gasp, Charlie Chaplin.
Hello. Thanks, all of you, for coming. It's great to be here and read with Glenn. I wore my best Sunnyside dress. and I'm going to read just a short piece of a chapter early in the book that is kind of a little bit of backstory, maybe a little bit. So the narrator's name is Rose, and it's kind of looking back to childhood. We lived in this house all my life. My parents had met in Berkeley as college students, but they got married right after graduation, moved to LA for dad's law school, and my mother gave birth to my brother Joseph shortly after they'd bought and settled into the place on Willoughby. She'd had trouble picking a major in college, unsure what she liked, but she chose the house right away because it was boxy and friendly, with red roof tiles and a mass of bougainvillea pouring over the door awning. And the diagonal diamond-shaped window patterns in the front looked like they could only frame a family that was happy. Dad studied hard, did well on his tests, shook hands with his teachers. He made sheets of checklists on pads of yellow legal paper, lists reminding him to talk to the librarian, give green sweater to homeless guy on Jefferson, buy apples. Find a wife hadn't been on any visible list, but he had proposed earlier than most of his peers, and something did seem to get checked off inside him once they were married. He bought gifts in line with the anniversary materials and framed their best wedding photograph for the hallway. And even though have a son and have a daughter looked better on paper than in the crying and diapering day after day, my father was pleased by the elder son, younger daughter arrangement. The world had matched up what he'd dreamed up, and he settled himself inside what they'd made. He was cheerful enough when he came home from work, but he didn't really know what to do with little kids, so he never taught us how to ride a bike or wear a mitt, and our changes in height remained unmarked on the door frames, so we grew tall on our own without proof. He left at the same time each morning and came home at the same time each evening, and my earliest memories of my mother were of her waiting at the door as soon as it was anywhere near time, me on her hip, Joseph at her hand, watching car after car drive by. He was never late, but she watched early anyway. During the afternoons, when she was tired of kid activity, she would sometimes roll around a white plastic wiffle ball and tell us stories of our first few years. In particular, she told us stories of our births. For some reason, Dad refused to go into hospital, so Mom had given birth to each of us by herself, while Dad waited outside on the sidewalk, sitting on a crate, half reading a detective story. "Lucky me," she said as she pushed the plastic wobbly ball over. "I got to meet you both first." When Dad got home, he'd bound up the walk and throw open the door, kissing her, kissing us, lining up his shoes, sifting through the mail. If anyone had been crying for any reason, he'd pull out a tissue and pat down our cheeks and say salt was for meat, not faces. Then he'd run out of greetings and glance around at the walls until he headed off to the room to change. What my father did most comfortably and best was log those long hours while my mother bathed and fed and clothed and burped, viewing the world at large as the vastest of colleges, a repeat of the trouble she'd had earlier deciding on a major. Possibility seemed to close in on her. "I love everything," she told me when I was still little enough to sit high on her hip. "I don't know what I like," she said brightly, kissing me on the nose. "You're so cute," she said, "so cute. You. I hardly knew any of my other relatives. Either they lived far away or they were dead. Three of my four grandparents had passed on to other unknowns by the time I was four, But my mother's mother was apparently as healthy as an Olympian, even though she'd never exercised a day in her life. She lived north, in Washington State. She hated travel, so she didn't visit, but one Saturday afternoon during my eighth year, a big brown box package arrived at our doorstep with Grandma in capital letters as the return address. "A package," I said, dragging my parents to the door. "Is it somebody's birthday?" "No," Mom said stiffly, pushing it inside with her foot. Inside, beneath layers of foam, I found a dish towel with my name on it. "For Rose," she had written in spidery handwriting on the scrap of paper taped to the towel itself. It was frayed, the pattern faded. I grabbed it out of the box and held it to my cheek. "What is this?" Dad asked, pushing foam strips onto the floor and lifting out a chipped, daisy-patterned teacup with his paper taped to it. "To Paul." "Her broken teacup?" he said. Joseph's gift was a series of clean blue pillowcases, and my mother's name was attached to a plastic bag full of cracked tins of rouge. "She's old now," Mom had said, circling a bit of rouge onto the back of her hand. Grandma lived alone and probably at that point had lost part of her mind, but no one dared move her. "She can still get to the post office, right?" said Mom, shuttling the bag of rouges to the back of a kitchen drawer. Dad pulled handfuls of coins from his pockets. "Whew," he said. "Not a lot of love lost between you two." He dumped all his change into the teacup so that no one would ever drink out of it. I loved my dish towel. This one was two-toned and had on one side stitchings of fat purple roses on a lavender background, and on the other side, fat lavender roses on a purple background. Which side to use? An optical illusion namesake with which I could dry our dishes. It was soft and worn and smelled like no-nonsense laundry detergent. Because she did not visit in person, Grandma called once a month, on Sunday afternoons, and my mother would gather us around, put the phone in the center of the kitchen table, and press speaker. She was gruff, Grandma, but funny. She liked to tell about her geology rock parties, where she had invited people over to the house to dig up and label rocks from the yard, and when they walked in the door, she specifically requested that no one speak. "Sometimes I even put tape on their mouths," she said. "If they let me, it was bliss. You understand, Joseph, correct?" "Yes," said Joe. "We did drink a lot," said Grandma, a little wistfully. "That you, Rose? You there?" "Hi, Grandma," I said. "You're too quiet," said Grandma. "Speak up." I rolled a vinyl placemat into a tube. "I love you," I said through the tube. There was a pause. Across the room from her listening position, wedged in the far corner, Mom flinched. "Love," said Grandma through the tiny black holes. "Yes," I said. "But you don't even know me," said Grandma. "How can you love me? It should be earned. You're too clingy. She's too clingy, Lane," Grandma said. "Ma," said Mom, picking at the ends of her ponytail. "I'm not clingy," I said. "She is extremely clingy," said Joseph. "What rocks did you find?" "How are things there, Ma?" Mom asked. "All's good?" "No," Grandma said. "All is not good. They're taking away my driver's license." "Basalt, Joseph," she said. "We found a whole lot of basalt. I'll send you some." Boxes of it the following week, dark and glassy. We repopulated the garden. When a teacher had us draw our grandparents for an assignment on ancestry, I monopolized the black crayon, and my picture had been of a thick black box with grating, lines extending outward to indicate voice. Here. You want to take out a couple props?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all right. We have some props.
Oh, yeah, we have props. Sorry. It's an intense choreography that went along with this.
There's a little Morocco. Okay, all right. Here's a couple books. There's a smell of chicken.
Okay, good. Okay, Amy brought more props.
Good. In case we have a little musical moment.
Good, excellent.
All right.
Good. So yeah, first of all, very very nice to have all of you here. And also, I thought that, Amy and I thought we probably should mention that we do know each other.
Yes. 15 years.
15 years. Yeah, September 1995.
Yes.
As I remember it was the we met at the UC Irvine fiction writing program. It was day one, and there was a large room of brand new graduate students in all the different programs for the English department together, and then sitting in a couch in the very back
There you were.
There you were, and I think you came in, you rode in on your motorcycle. Not into the room, but right?
Not in the room, right, yeah. Yeah.
Had a helmet under right. your arm.
Yeah, no, yeah, I came in late, unfortunately.
Well, and I think that Glenn and I were in that workshop and then have been friends now for 15 years, and are readers of each other's work, so it feels like a great opportunity to have a little dialogue here. So thank you, Louise.
Yeah, it's very nice to have you guys here. one of the things I was going to ask you some questions about things. Now, one of the things is we have a workshop where I got to see early versions of Amy's work and she of mine. And so, in a way, we know a lot about each other's processes and how things work and stories. But there's a lot of stuff I still don't know.
Yeah, likewise.
About you. And so we just kind of prepared some questions and then we'll riff. But
yeah.
One of the things that we have, although our work, it's interesting that you read that piece, the family-based and very emotionally forward and lovely connecting, and I read the kind of the historically-based larger thing.
Right, the sweep or the entry in.
Yeah, it is. You are one of my best readers, and that you address things that I would never see in a million years in there. And so the fact that we have stuff in common is also interest in me. One of them being intense anxiety.
Which is why the title,
Performance Anxiety.
Right.
Performance Anxiety, yeah.
There's a slash between, so we can talk about performance. Well, and also theater. I think there are all these commonalities that are interesting, right? There's kind of a love of theater on the page.
Yeah.
And magic in different ways. Mm-hmm. And, anxiety of all sorts.
Yeah.
And
I would say that when we were in the background preparing there, I noticed we were both very anxiously doing our previous routines about making sure that everything looked fine,
right,
and that we wouldn't embarrass ourselves being out here. One of the books that was completely seminal to me in becoming a writer, I was actually surprised Amy hadn't heard of it today. It's called Art and Fear. Are you plotting for art or for
awesome.
Fear? Both. Art and Fear together. That's terrific. It's observations on the perils and rewards of art making. And is it okay? Can I start with this?
Please,
okay.
Please.
All right. One of the things that was interesting to me is that the argument in this book is that art is generally a triumph against fear, that as you make art, there's all kinds of different things you need to struggle against. In a way, the definition of a working artist is somebody who's learned to cope with, not defeat, but just kind of acknowledge and continue with those fears from moment to moment. One of the things that, they said, what separates artists from ex-artists is those...
Ex-artists,
from
wow.
Ex-artists,
wow.
Is those who challenge their fears continue, those who don't quit. Talk about fear briefly.
All right, great. I think that's true to a certain degree, and I think sometimes the fear is just the sitting down and just sitting through what I feel like is this profound restlessness that will come in when writing, that if I have something that I'm working on that's productive, then that's a very nice writing day. But most days aren't like that. So there's this kind of intense restlessness and you want to do anything but stay there. And I think for me, like the rule that I have for myself is it's all about just staying in the chair as opposed to even getting work done. It is literally comes down to staying put in the chair. So I think that is... And the story, just now we're on grad school, but the story is that I started to write under a routined amount of time when Irvine started because I felt like, well, I should do it. And so the first couple days I did tie my foot to the chair with a scarf, which I think I've told you that.
Yeah.
And it was a gesture towards myself because I could have unknotted that scarf pretty easily, but it was like a gesture of like, it's going to take at least 1 minute of effort to get out of this chair.
Yeah.
And then I stayed put. Anyway, so I feel like that is about... the fear of just staying, the whole butt in chair thing that people talk about.
That's fantastic. Well, it's interesting because I actually, to move it a little bit from fear into anxiety.
Yeah, they're certainly related.
Okay, what do you do about the internet?
Right. No, and I want to talk to you in terms of research, right? Because Glenn is this amazing researcher and there's this incredible amount of material that gets processed through you and then ends up on the page. And it feels like then we can take it in and we don't have to do the research, which is a pleasure. Because I'm not a big researcher, then the internet is not a draw.
So when you're working, you don't check email. You don't have because that is the thing about getting yourself out of the chair when you're not out of the chair.
Right. That there are things you can do in the chair that make you out of the chair.
Right.
Right. No, I think So I'll undo the email program. I'll quit.
Yeah.
That's the word.
Quit.
I'll quit that email program and that Firefox so that
very sophisticated.
Yeah. But now, what do you do?
I don't.
You don't. You'll have it on.
Yeah. No. Oh. I do. No. But what I it's the big struggle for me. Actually, the book that's been game changing for me recently is The Shallows by Nicholas Carr.
Yeah, I've been interested in this book.
Yeah. Because what one of his arguments is that we get smarter in a way, broader by looking at the net, but we get a lot dumber in any depth.
Yeah.
Because the idea of having a bunch of windows open at once is contrary to how we actually process things. Yeah. And so if you notice that it trickles down even into like television, where there's no longer just one image on the screen of television, but there's now a coming attractions on the bottom and little flashing ads on the side. It's like a George Saunders story has come to life in a way.
Yeah.
But for me, it's an issue because I do need to research things sometimes.
So how do you segment it?
I segment it that there's times when I'm researching when I'm not working.
Yeah.
You know, but I do have to. I turn off. I unplug. I actually take out the network when I'm working.
Do you take out the modem?
I take the modem, the
router or whatever.
The printer thing.
Right.
The plug. Whatever that plug thing.
Green dots.
Is.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or. Yeah. The thing with the little fire, the little trident devil thing. Yeah, yeah. It is a devil
thing. Okay, so you'll unplug that.
Unplug that.
That's yours tying your leg to the chair with the scarf.
That is my chain. Yeah, yeah. Now, it used to be, when I was working on Carter Beats the Devil, I was addicted to solitaire.
Oh,
for the same reason.
And
you know how I got out of it?
No.
I wrote a scene with a character playing solitaire obsessively.
Nice.
I just wrote about that, and then in a way, it kind of drummed it out of my system.
Yeah. So then do you feel, what happens to you if you're sitting there, you're working on a scene, and all you want to do is go onto the internet and research it? Like, what does it feel like?
It feels terrible.
Yeah.
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 I'd say that's actually probably the biggest struggle is to maintain that focus on the page, because what happens is as you work, as you know, you get to a place where there's either a phrase or a word or the next scene or there's something that you can't quite get to. And the natural thing for you is your brain has to leave that page for a while and then circle around and come back to it in a different way. And you might come into a different place in the scene. You might like click into a different story. You might be in a different place in it. There's something that happens. Actually, my whole book came to a standstill when one character offers another a drink and I didn't know whether he said yes or no. And I think it was 3 months. So
3 months of standstill.
Yeah, standstill. Yeah,
yeah,
literally.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, and the reason why was that about three lines beforehand, there was something else that should have happened, but I didn't know.
Oh, interesting.
So the thing is with the internet is the immediate idea is, oh, instead of doing this, I'll just, you know,
right.
And I'll just let my mind play for a minute. Your mind isn't playing.
Right.
You know, it's doing something else.
Right. No, and I was thinking of it recently as like a bubble or something can get punctured, which is that there's that instinct. I think we've all, because of all the technology, we are programmed a little bit more to want to be distracted. You know, you want to check the phone or you want to check the email or whatever. But that instinct of checking something, like just today I was working and I just remembered something that seemed important at the moment that I thought I should jot down. And then, you know, to feel like the thing actually was not important at all. It was something I either would forget or remember later. At the moment, it felt of dire importance to remember, you know, to do laundry later in the day or something like that, right? I mean, it's on that level. But what it is it's a tug away from the restlessness. I think it's, and the important thing for me is I can have the thought I should write down that I need to do laundry, but it's kind of important that to try to avoid writing down I need to do laundry, because the writing down is sort of the puncturing of the bubble of restlessness in a certain way, so that the restlessness can mean that I'm having all these other thoughts, but that I'm not following them. I'm not.
Do you have is it number of hours a day that you work?
I do 2 hours in the morning.
Two hours in the morning. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm 800 words right now.
Oh, okay.
And that seems to be kind of handy for me, because the hours, actually, just thinking about that, there's something that produces like, oh my God, how am I going to fill 2 hours?
Yeah. It can be horrible.
But
yeah.
The 800 words somehow, like I can sort of count them out as they're going and go back and keep rereading.
Yeah, no, that's nice. Yeah.
We are fun at parties, though.
All right, I want to ask you a question. I have these various different questions, but I'm going to ask you about spectacle and performance in theater, because I think one thing I really love so much about Glenn's writing is there's this feeling in both novels, this is such a huge part of these incredible scenes that are spectacle, like if it's war or if it's a magic show or if it's movies or if it's a giant fundraiser or if it's, you know, Mary Pickford, like there is something about your sense of bigness of a moment that is incredibly theatrical, right? but it's through language. It's incredibly visual, but it's not visual. So it appears to be like film, and it appears to be like theater, but it's fiction. And I guess one question I have for you is, how does that work for you? When you're building a scene, which I'm sure you are imagining very visually in your mind, like, what is that like to then build that through language? Because I think you're so good at language. You know, every sentence feels really beautifully made. So you're living in this, you know, and this is why I think sometimes Glenn will get compared to Doctorow. I think that's that feeling is what that comparison is about, because I think he has a similar feeling too. So I would love to hear you talk about that a little bit.
Sure. That's actually, no one's ever asked me that before.
Ah, good. That's my goal, is to ask Glenn things. He has not been.
A lot of that is kind of under the ice in a mm-hmm. way. It's not something that I really consciously think of, but now I will. I think what happens is that I see things first.
Okay.
I definitely, and then I have to find a way to translate them. And I do feel every time that I'm trying to tell somebody what I've seen.
Huh.
And
huh.
I don't have a single perfect audience in mind.
Okay. Now,
it's kind of like I actually have a friend who's a songwriter who like played me a few songs in a row that all had you in it. You know, when I talk to you, it's like, who is this you person? Mm. And there is no you. It's like it's like sort of a phantom in your mind. I think I do have kind of, in a way, a perfect audience is Jim Sveta. Sort of imagine that if I were talking to Jim Sveta, what would amuse him the most in there? That's one identity. But I think that I am trying to explain what I've seen in my head. It's like trying to, you know how hard it is? I heard that in a way that people have sometimes compared your stories to dreams, but that's mm-hmm. not at all accurate.
Hmm.
Because dreams have a type of logic that's not interesting to anybody else. And your stories definitely do have an internal logic that somehow leaps over that fence to other people. And I was going to ask you actually this specifically, which is that one of the things I do like is that your characters often ask each other the wrong questions.
Huh.
That if there's an impossible setup, they never ask about the setup, but it's always the small details that they talk to each other about. But it's never challenged. Is that something you find yourself have to edit out? When you have an imaginary world, do you find yourself having to edit out any questioning of the continuity?
Well, I think, and it's interesting because it's different forms of sort of spectacle in certain ways too, right? You know, it feels like I think they're related, that if there is some sort of dreamlike world happening, you know, that is its own strange visual world too. But in terms of people commenting, I think in general, like there's something about the matter of fact and some kind of magic realism or fairy tale like storytelling where something is outrageous and then the characters just accept it. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of the nature of the storytelling, is they are going to talk about the small things and maybe ignore the giant things. But what's interesting, it feels like that balance is always the balance for me, is figuring out what's commented upon and what's not. So I'm not actually editing it out in those stories. But in the new book, I feel like the characters are actually a little shocked by the magical elements mm-hmm. in the book. And that's part of the book, I think, is that experience of both accepting that there are magical things that can happen, but also that the characters are upset and thrown off balance by them, so they don't expect that to happen, as opposed to something like, drawing a total blank, but or in a story in The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, if there's a mermaid who goes to high school, there's no question of like, a mermaid can't go to high school because she needs to be in water.
Right. You know, send them to your uncle Hunchback, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That those things have to be put out really straight. And I think that is sometimes more of a short story feeling because it's these short, direct sentences mm-hmm. that then lead to that acceptance.
Gerardo Mejia, report to the first floor security office. Gerardo Mejia, report to the first floor security office. Atención, Gerardo Mejia. Al primer piso.
Tagalog, next.
Gerardo Mejia, primer piso, seguridad. Gracias.
Then Mandarin. Then,
okay. Right.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Glenn Golds, we would like to see you.
That's right. The authorities have finally caught up. Yeah.
But do you, I mean, what is your feeling about theater in terms of?
In terms of running, in a way, it's been a happy accident. I keep going back to it. I keep starting other things that are not theatrically based and then finishing the ones that are.
Interesting.
And in part, you know, I think in part is because when I grew up, I read a lot of comic books, and they were interested in presenting things as dramatically as possible.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ideas about the best artists were the ones who had the perspective most perfectly skewed, so that when you turn the page, the villain shown, you know, when Jack Kirby's drawing Dr. Doom, there's, you know, some sort of feeling that you're really seeing something amazing, even if you aren't.
Yeah.
And I feel that there's something in common there with a lot of theater and with cinema as well. And to me, I think that, you know, when we came into the graduate program together, one of the things that's kind of cool about having known you for a while is getting to see both continuity and change in your work. And the first couple short stories you submitted to workshop, actually, if you can kind of imagine this, I mean, one of the good things about being in workshop is, you know, we meet and we talk and, like, go out for drinks and stuff, but we hadn't read each other's work the first week, and so there's this, oh, God, she's cool, I hope she doesn't suck, you know, and then it's like, whew, we could, okay. And so you turn in your first stories, and they were great, but they didn't have the kind of magical side to them at first. And then it felt like, if I'm right about this, as a reader, it felt, okay, now Amy has gotten the confidence to show us what's actually going on. Is that what was going on at the time?
Well, and in some ways, I mean, I feel like you guys played a direct role in this, which is that I was writing a lot shorter than other people, so I could turn in two pieces, and so one was sometimes realistic, and then one would be a little less realistic, and I got such a resounding vote of confidence in the less realistic one and a kind of tepid response to the realistic one, mm-hmm. which was shocking to me, because I felt sure that I was like, now that I'm in a workshop, I should write, you know, stories like the stories I had seen more of in kind of literary journals. Yeah. And
were you reading a lot of literary journals?
I was looking, yeah. Yeah, I was reading some. Yeah. But so it was this incredible gateway when you guys said, oh, no, this one is better. So that did, it was a boost of confidence, but it was also unbelievable permission.
Yeah.
But I didn't expect it at all.
And then what's interesting is now, in the current book, Rose and her family, they live in a town. They live in Los Angeles. So geography seems to be coming into your work in a way, like grounding it in a world, which I don't remember. It's not in the previous novel. And then, for the most part, not in the short stories so much.
Yeah.
There seems to be like a withholding of geography. And now there it is. What was that, a conscious decision?
It was, yeah, it was a conscious decision. And some of it was that it again goes to this, I guess, sense of language. And I felt like, initially I felt really liberated to feel like I didn't have to name places and that things could be a town or a barn or a farm, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that those words, I'm drawn to those words, to how those words look on a page, and then not feeling obligated to name the place. And I felt like one of our teachers, Judith Grossman, was really helpful about saying that gives it more mythic quality, and, you know, you can kind of run with that more mythic quality. But then I think there was a feeling of, well, I know L.A. really well. I grew up in L.A. I live here now, and so why not talk about L.A.? Because it wasn't, it was language that I could sort of easily access, you know, words about plants or street names or all of that. So that it ended up being fun. And in some ways, then it makes it, I mean, in some ways, the book is both then more grounded in realism because it's a specific place, but then the magical parts, maybe it's a stranger combo.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so back at you. It's sort of a zigzag, but that's all right. So my question about Sunnyside 2, or just what I would love to hear you talk about, because I've heard you talk about it a little bit before, is the difference between the process of writing Carter and writing Sunnyside. In terms of, I remember you talking about with Sunnyside, you were circling around an idea.
Yeah.
And that was a very different way of going about novel writing. And I think the other thing that's interesting, too, is in terms of people finding readers for each other's work, is that Glenn and I craft a book really differently. And I think, you know, like you'll say you'll kind of know where a scene is going, but you won't know something in it. Like you have more direction in a certain way. So would you just talk about this idea of how how this concept of writing the book around an idea was born?
Yeah, Carter, which is my first published novel, I wrote four very bad novels beforehand that will never see the light of day. That you read the first 40 pages.
I like the first 40 pages. I know.
Well, that was the only part of it that was good. Right. The rest of it was terrible. Do you know the story, by the way? The first agent I ever got to show my work to, I showed him the entirety of the novel that Amy saw the first 40 pages of. And what happened is that after he met me and figured I knew how to take criticism, at least okay, he put the first 40 pages in one pile, the next 101, and then the remainder in a big pile. And he's like, great, good, crap.
Wow.
And he's like, how old are you? And I said, I'm 30. He said, congratulations, you wanted to write the great American novel before you were 30, you failed. You're free.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
That's not a bad thing to say.
It's not entirely bad. So,
right? No, I think there's something. Taking off the pressure of the Great American Novel, I think, is right. Right from the Art and Fear book, right?
It's just true. It absolutely
can't sit
is.
Down to write the Great American Novel.
you definitely have to take away expectation. You have to, but that's part of the fear here is audience. Will you be loved after turning in this work that means something to you?
Right.
Will you be understood? Will you be accepted? Will there be approval? No. So, but that literally that's what you have to tell yourself is no. There's no hope of any of that. And just do what you can. But Carter, on the other hand, was as novel number 5. I turned that into workshop, and it was very different than anything I'd done before in that it was kind of a mystery. There was sort of an internal drive to it, and it was very, very plot-based in the way that you really wanted to solve what was going to happen, and there was a lot of fireworks going off in the corners. And when I was done with it, I was curious about what it would be like to write something that wasn't plot-based. And what kept coming back to me was this set of ideas, one within kind of this nested series of ideas of what is it that's really troubling me? And it came about that I wanted to write about power and how in the absence of there being any higher power, what it is people do to pursue power. And it led me immediately to Hollywood, strangely. I was interested in writing a novel about silent film, and it started out in a completely different place. But all roads, when you write about silent film, come back to Charlie Chaplin. He was the most powerful, richest man in the world. Our most highly paid man in the world at the time. And he created, in the course of a couple of minutes, the most known human face in history. Chaplin is better known than any other representation. He's the most known representation of a human face to this day. And I thought that was really interesting, and what does that kind of power do to somebody? And so I think one of the things we're circling around here is I had this idea about narrative that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Is that, okay, if Carter, in a way, a narrative we are familiar with goes like this. You know, part A, we see some robbers planning a heist. Part B, we see a heist. Part C, we see some robbers going to jail. So what's interesting to me about this book is I thought, what if it's a different set of robbers every time? So that you see kind of an action, you see a planning, you see action, and you see consequence, but you take it apart. You don't make it the same person undergoing those three separate things. What I found interesting is that people have the hardest time as readers accepting consequence. So the first two actions seem to go together very well, the planning and the execution. People see how those two things go together. And the third is a little more mythic and odd, like, oh, wait a minute, there's consequences to things? You know, it's a little difficult. But that's how that came to me, is that I didn't want to go with plot, but with idea. And it's a mixed bag. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works great. And I love hearing about that. We had started talking about that a little bit earlier, but there's something, because I think what you're pointing at is a certain way of reading that in a story, I think we're really looking for the consequences of actions. We're really tracking the consequences of actions. And I think we're looking for those consequences to tell us something about our own world and about morality. I mean, because in the classic sequence, the robbers go to jail because the robbers stole, and that is a kind of order to the universe, and we can settle in with it. But there's something, like one of my favorite books is the Haruki Murakami book, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, and it's because of that exact thing that you're talking about, which is the character, sort of don't want to spoil any of the plot lines, but the character does one action and there is a consequence, but it's extremely different than you would ever think. And then from that, there's a second consequence and a third consequence. And that there is a process happening, but that process is happening in an unusual way. And there's something about that that's so exciting, because I think we're all really good at piecing stories together. I mean, I think it's just a natural human ability. But so this idea of sort of skewing things where, okay, those robbers disappeared. What's happening here? I just find that extremely compelling.
What's interesting to me is do you find yourself when writing like thinking about like your stories like people drawing a moral from them about what happens to your characters, about that forming a worldview or not?
I don't think about it, but I think like if I look at fairy tales as a model, because fairy tales have that sense of cause and effect and consequences pretty laid out, and that's part of the pleasure of reading a fairy tale is you kind of know what's going to happen. You generally know good guys, mm-hmm. going, you know, to the ball, bad guys getting their eyes pecked out, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So I teach a fairy tale class, and the students are always shocked to be like, that Cinderella, was that really necessary that the sisters got their eyes pecked out? This version, yes, it was very necessary. So those consequences, I think, happen and have a certain moral weight in a fairy tale. But I think what's interesting is that then if you change those around, and I think part of the pleasure for me of writing is taking those assumptions, taking those structures that we're used to, and then messing them up so you're both in a familiar and an unfamiliar place at the same time, that you're like, oh, I kind of know where this story's going, and then it turns in a direction, and you think, oh, now it's going somewhere different, and does that shake us up, hopefully? And I do think, not that there's a moral in that there's a lesson or there's a way to, a takeaway, a sitcom feeling. But I think, and you had mentioned this earlier when we were prepping, but just that, you know, there is always something moral in a piece of writing. I had a teacher, Jane Vandenberg, who was like, every piece of writing is moral in some way because it either enforces the status quo or it upsets the status quo.
Yeah. That's true. So that ties in with something else we were talking about, which is that I was thinking one of the things that's been kind of churning in my head is that how I think that fiction is essentially either conservative or radical. And conservative fiction is the stuff that gets noticed first, I think, because it reinforces what we already know. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things it talks about in here in the book. That's what got off there, is that the sure way to go for reward is to do something that people have already seen before, only a little different. Don't go too far outside the boundaries. And the stuff that's truly radical often doesn't get noticed in its own lifetime. What's interesting is when there's stuff that masquerades as conservative, but in fact has underneath kind of a radical heart beating in it. And I think there's something about that somewhere in your new novel especially, and that you're let in by what, you know, you're let in, beginning with the title, with this way of coming into a family, and then by the end, without giving anything away, you're on a whole emotional roller coaster that this door has been opened inside of you in your heart that you didn't know was going to happen at first.
That's very nice.
It wasn't a question, was it?
I like hearing that.
I was going to ask you this, though. This is to go back to the art and fear thing. Okay, can I ask
yeah,
you?
Yeah, please.
Okay, here we go.
Do something with the stuffed chicken, but I don't know what to do with it.
Well, there'll be audience questions afterwards about what to do with the stuffed chicken. The authors recall a mutual friend whose single-minded quest for 20 years was to land a one-man show at his city's major art museum. He finally got it and never produced another piece of art again. There's a painful irony to stories like that, to discovering how frequently and easily success transmutes into depression, fear of success. Avoiding this fate has something to do with not letting your current goal become your only goal. And for a few physically risky art forms like dance, it may even mean keeping an alternative medium close by in case age or injury takes you from your chosen work. Their argument here is that with individual artworks, it means leaving some loose thread, some unresolved issue to carry forward and explore in the next piece. We've talked about fear of failure and fear of success before. Do you have any dangling threads that you find yourself keep following?
I think you have to have dangling threads because I think we're all a bunch of dangling threads. I mean, at Truth, no one is a wrapped up ball of thread inside, you know, no one. So I think some of it is just paying attention to which are the threads that are dangling, because I think, you know, it's an interesting thing with goals, and, you know, you put work out there and you get responses to the work, and that's exciting or upsetting or whatever. But then it always, I think, does come down to that initial question of sitting down and write something. Like, basically, to me, when I hear the dangling threads, what that means to me is, you know, do you still have an unconscious after you've made some art? Huh. And I feel like you always do until you die. Like, you just always have things you don't know that you can explore. But you have to then go back to sitting and looking at them. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think...
All right. Good.
Yeah. Well, I didn't even hear a question mark in there. I said with confidence. And generally, you know, confidence is what God gives the talentless as a consolation prize. So this was, you know... I think that's exactly right. And I think that living on the... in the moments of your work, of your 2 hours of the day or 800 words, without any self-consciousness, mm-hmm. is kind of the key to continuing to make things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't feel like there's like a well that will dry up that I right. keep going back to. And I've been interested in reading artists' biographies, the ones who keep making stuff versus the ones who don't, or the ones who, when they succeed, go back and make that same clay pot over and over again with just a different lacquer on it. And it's interesting with people who keep needing to move and challenge themselves. It does. It keeps replenishing itself.
Interesting quote. I like it. Okay. So, we're going to do questions in 3 minutes, but maybe can I do one other?
Oh, good God. Are we almost?
Geez. I know. It goes so quick. Okay. And here's just another question I have, which is that when I initially heard, I guess I saw some pages of Sunnyside, and I remember Glenn read from the first chapter, and I remember reading the first chapter. And the dominant feeling I had that I just loved was feeling like the prose was taking care of me. Like I just felt like his care with the language and with the images and even just things like the water and her stripes or no stripes. There's something about the care in detail that I feel like is very generous to a reader. And so I'm wondering just if you're aware of that or if that's about scene building for you or if it rings a bell somewhere.
Ring bell. You weren't in Wilton Henry James class, were you?
I was not. I was in the Joyce class.
You were in the Joyce class. This goes back to, this is graduate school stuff. Wilton taught a class on Henry James and then one on James Joyce.
Wilton Barnhart.
Wilton had pointed out something about Henry James, which was his relationship, the idea of the author having a relationship with the audience is something that has changed quite a bit in the last 100 years. In a way, the author either has an ego and gets in the way of the work to a certain extent. There's like this continuum all the way from this work is about me to I am invisible and I'm out here, I don't exist, this is a keyhole you can look through. And James seemed to have a different thing, because if you look in his very sentences, there'd be like, Isabel Archer said, I should concur, and there'd be this, who is this I in there? Who's this authorial I that shows in here? I must say, or I would hesitate to say. And in a way, I started to notice in reading Portrait of a Lady and things like that, that there was this idea of there being this host who's there to make sure that you have a good time and show you to your chair and bring you treats.
Yeah, that's nice.
And at the same time, you should be aware that you're like, there's somebody in your house.
Yeah.
And you are taking care of them. So yeah, there is something to that. I guess the thing you try to, in that continuum, to get away from is unctuousness or something, you don't want to be too much,
right.
Too cute, too arch.
Right, but I never felt that in your stuff.
Tremendously sweet. Thank you. I was going to ask you this.
Can I jump on that for a sec too? Because I think... it's just the host thing, I think, is really nice. And I guess what I would say is there's a beautiful quote by Paul Auster, which is something like, writer and reader make the book both. I think that's the quote, but I'm not exactly sure that that's it. But I think maybe I'm becoming increasingly aware that it is that duet and that, I'm not thinking about audience, but that there's just something about knowing that it is, it relates to the guy who, his goal was to have the one man art show and then he never did art again, which is that there is a forgetting that you want a connection to the person who's seeing it or reading it. Because I think if you want that connection, that's ongoing. I think that's the same process of the threaded, whatever it was, the draped thread, what was the word? So I just think there's something about the host acknowledges that there's someone reading it, and just, I don't know, I guess I like that in terms of all the multimedia and everything, there's something about then fiction is deeply intimate. It's one person and another person meeting on the page, and they have a connection, and then they go away. And we can be up here talking about it, but, our hope is that you read the book and have that connection in that way, and this will only be like a surface-level glance at something that happens in a different way on the page. But I guess I just feel like I'm increasingly aware of that, and it's like fuel. I think it's helpful in terms of the sitting back down.
That's much better than the question I was going to ask.
All right. That's good.
I think that could be done at this point. Okay.
People in the audience.
This is good. Thank you.
Thanks. We're going to turn to you.
We're going to pass around. There's going to be a microphone, and we are going to point at people. We're going to select people, and we're going to point at them. Wait. Hands going up.
Hands
who do you want to point at here?
Chris. Hi.
Let's see. This guy looks pretty pointable
yeah,
over here.
Exactly. It looks great. Yeah. I know.
Go for one and then keep.
And there was a hand here and there was a hand there.
One and then.
I have a mic.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Do. Great.
First of all, thanks for this incredibly interesting conversation. One comment about the artist who wants the one-person show, the one-man show, that's about display, which I think is really interesting because what you're just talking about in terms of an exchange between a reader and a writer is not about display, right? Amy teaches writing. Do you teach?
I have.
So can you just talk a little bit about how, because you've both been students of writing, the MFA program at Irvine's famous, and it certainly was very famous in the period that you guys were there, and you can talk about that a little if you want, but how's it different from being a student of writing to then being a teacher of writing and continuing to write?
It's another 6 hours.
Yeah, right, it's true. Right, the mini version.
Yeah, Amy's taught a lot more than I have. I've taught a couple of workshops. I just taught at St. Mary's last quarter, and I had the kind of the shell shock. If anybody here is a student of mine, I apologize for the last quarter. I think I went through that thing with teaching where you know what it's like to be a student, and you know what it's like to be both like sussing out whether the teacher's bullshit or not, and whether they've sold out or not, and whether they actually are tuned to your work or not, and shutting out a lot of other things. It was interesting to be on the other side of it. I think that I probably need to do it a few more times to understand better the experience I was having there. Are you in there?
Well, and I guess I've been teaching now because I taught as soon as I left college. My first job I got was teaching elementary school, so I've been teaching now almost 20 years, which is shocking. But I think, I mean, it feels to me like it's a very different activity than writing, which is why I think I like it, is that it works as a kind of foil to writing. But it's, and I like talking around writing. Like, I like, in terms of talking here, I like the idea that you can't really talk about the process of writing, but you can talk around it a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's fun for me to talk about it. And I think, I mean, I'll usually feel like on the first couple classes, the students are kind of sussing out, and there is that sussing out. And then as soon as they're turning in work, as soon as that sort of happens, and we're talking about the work, and they know that they're not going to be humiliated, basically, then something turns in the class in a nice way. So I really enjoy it. I mean, I think what I enjoy, too, is you can start to see in the language when someone is more engaged. You can really see it on the page, and that it's not that difficult for me to just point that out and say, page 4, you're there. page 3, you're spacing out, or you're distracted, or you're performing in a bad way, or something. And that just starts to hopefully teach someone when their work is working, because you don't know when you sit down. Like when I was at Irvine, I was turning in 2 stories. I really thought the first one was the one I would get kudos for, and it was like one of those giant instant lessons that it wasn't, because it was a reminder that the stuff that I like to write was actually more interesting. And that people don't know that. We don't know that most basic thing, which is that your level of engagement shows.
And just to tag on to that just for a moment, I think that one of the lessons of graduate school is how to take criticism and how not to. I mean, one of the first things I say in writing programs is that, you know, they're the two types of students, the ones who really need to have their confidence built up and the ones who need to have their confidence beaten out of them.
Yeah, that seems. Yeah, that's smart.
So. Right here? Yeah, okay. And then.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you, both of you. It's been lovely. My first question is for Mr. Gold. In the beginning, the lighthouse is just so specific, and I really don't know anything about lighthouses, but I felt...
You don't?
No, I know. And my last name is Light, and it's crazy. I'm wondering, it seems like you do a lot of research. I have this theory that there's two types of people, one that can retain that kind of information, and two, the people that can't, and I'm in the second group. And no matter what I read, I can retain the emotional life and that sort of... I can look at the world that way, but I really can't retain any of the research that I do, and then like have it organically come up in my process. Otherwise, I just feel like I'm plagiarizing if I even use a word that I normally would never use. You know, so I'm wondering. So does it just kind of come naturally to you when you research? Do you just, it just flows out?
It's a good question. Actually, to your two types of people, I would add a third: those who make stuff up.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
but I would. add, you know, what you said though is actually really important, which is the emotional life of something. Mm-hmm. I'm married to a writer too, and the way my research always begins is I read something in a book that has nothing to do with anything, and I'll say over, like, you know, at lunch, you know, hey, Alice, this thing, and I say the sentence, and she just kind of stares at me, and she shakes her head, and she's like, "That's not interesting." Put it in a story. Yeah. I'm like, okay, it's true, because what's actually interesting is the emotional content of research. Research on its own is dead. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the that lighthouse is interesting because of the idea of a woman running it, mm-hmm. and the families that go there, and that Charlie Chaplin is a boat off there. And your sense of drama and possibility all comes from the description of the lighthouse. The lighthouse itself is just, it's nothing. So it's all about figuring out what details accentuate drama, and drama comes from emotion.
Mm. And can I ask one more question? I'm sorry. Ms. Bender, I'm listening to your book on audiobook right now, and I'm almost done, and I just have to say thank you. I really, I never like to listen to books that are read by the author. I know that's horrible, but I had to make an exception because when I sampled you, you were just lovely. And I'm wondering, do you read your work aloud to yourself as you're writing, and do you ever... for instance, when I read my work aloud, sometimes I feel like I'm too good at reading it aloud. And, you know, I it sounds better than it actually is. Have you ever come across that? That's it.
I mean, and first, I'm glad to hear it, because doing the audiobook was, like, both exciting and then terrifying. And it's so different than reading to an audience, because an audience gives you feedback right away, and then it's just me in a little booth with the woman saying, like, "No, they all sound exactly the same. You know, can you vary the voices a little?" And I was like, "No, I don't know how to do that. How do I do that?" And then, you know, I shouldn't say this, but then at some point it dawned on me that it was like, "God damn it, I have two French characters towards the end. What am I going to do?" Like, it was really like, I had this unbelievable dread of, like, I do not. So, I mean, I shouldn't say that, because I really don't want you guys to hear what I ended up. I don't know what happened with it. Anyway, but yes, I read my work aloud. I love reading my work aloud. And I think sometimes, yeah, you can read things and you know what to emphasize. So it is a little different. But also, there's plenty of times that I read work aloud and it doesn't work aloud. So I think if you're reading aloud and you're enjoying hearing it aloud, then that is a nice day and something to celebrate.
I'm doing this.
Yeah, no, good, please.
Executive
you're
pointing
great
over here.
Executive pointing.
No, go ahead.
Here's the
mic
right there.
I am curious about how each of you edits. I'm sure you each have your own style, and I'm curious if it's more sort of like you overwrite and you find yourself needing to slash, or if you write just a small, minimal scene and you need to embellish, or how many times you'll sort of rewrite a sentence to make it just perfect, and what your tics are, and where the pleasure is, and then where you feel maybe you're going to self-sabotage.
Yeah.
Branding on that, yeah.
Sure. Well, it's interesting, because I think a lot about, in terms of that whole idea of, like, telling a student page 4 is working, page 3 is working, what that's doing is to say, hopefully, start to notice your state of mind when you're writing. And when does your good writing happening? What kind of state of mind are you in? Because people are in all sorts. And I think it's the same with editing, because I think there is a moment when editing becomes damaging, and when it becomes compulsive, and when it becomes picking at a scab, is the way I like to think of it. And we all know that feeling when the scab is starting to peel off, and you're like, "I shouldn't do this." Ah! You know, like... And that is not a productive editing place. But that the other feeling is that I think if it feels like you are getting work done, that you are back in the scene. And I mean, I'll start editing the next day. I'll be going back into the scene. But if I feel interested in it, then I'll cut things and I'll add things, and it'll just start to kind of expand and grow. But it feels, it's a very good writing day, those writing days, because I have something to do. And I think there are those moments when I don't really know what to do with the story and I'm ready to, you know, hammer at it, and those are moments to work on something else, I would say.
Yeah, I'm both a taker-outer and putter-inner. I think my editing process really begins with showing the work to other people and getting other viewpoints on what it is I'm doing and whether it's coming across or not. Because to me, the first place I know when I'm actually writing something okay is in tone, when I feel like I can hear the tone of it. And then everything else is like kind of a level of detail and engagement after that.
Here. Do you both still work sometimes or at all in that writer's workshop kind of context where you take your work to a group and you all work it over? And if so, why do you? And if not, why don't you anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think like what I'll do is there's a small group. Glenn is included in that small group. And if a work is at a certain readiness, then I'll give it to a few people and get feedback and sometimes meet in person and sometimes talk via email or the phone. Ideally, we'll meet in person. And I think what's nice is at that point, it's been many, many years, so it's both a readership and a friendship. So I think there can be two levels of commentary. There's levels of commentary about the page and then saying, like, I think you're doing that thing that you did before. Like, there's just a lot of experience at that point. So that's an incredibly precious relationship to me and worth it. But it has changed since workshop when it was, like, turning something once a month. You know, now it's on more like every other year or something, you know, with a big chunk.
Yeah, and you know, since we met through workshop, I mean, I've said this about my wife before, who is that, and it's also true about Amy, is that one of the things that the foundation of our friendship is work, mm-hmm. and also mm-hmm. taking critique of each other's work, and so it's both. I do it in part because it was better for my writing than anything else I'd done before was being in that workshop at UCI, and then second of all, it's a continuity amongst us, and also. It makes it better all the way around. Okay.
There had been a hand over here.
Yeah, we saw hands.
But it was gone. Yes, this was the hand. It's you.
The question is for Mr. Gold. I was wondering if you could speak particularly about the influences of the 1920s and so on your life. I kind of see that also in film noir and wondering... You know, it's this beautiful time, a time of turmoil, yet it comes across so cleanly on a page and on film, and it's something that really resounds 100 years later when Avatar isn't going to be in 3D, but yet the story will continue. I don't see that for a lot of new and modern stuff. You think if it's not on an e-book and it doesn't have flashing pictures, maybe it doesn't really mean anything 100 years from now, but I see... your work really being different. I'm wondering if you could talk about the early American century and how it was your impact.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, the 1920s, it's kind of had a weird... My affinity with the 1920s started when I was about 6 years old, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and my dad just happened to be watching Marx Brothers movie at like 2 a.m. And I thought this is what adults did in the middle of the night. I was like, I... had better find out as much as I can about the Algonquin table at 6, you know. And so while the other kids were, you know, this was the time of Evel Knievel and Brian's Song and this is mid-70s, I was like, do you know that Margaret Dumont and Groucho Marx weren't actually friends? You know, I'm going to get hit, you know. But that to me was like kind of the height of sophistication was that era. And I think that one of the things that I kept learning from reading those books was that there was a time when that kind of wit was prized. And the more I found out about the art and about the architecture and about the kind of the nuances of the time, the more I felt an affinity for it. Also, I think that there's kind of a... we look back on that as perhaps a naive time or something, but also the beginning of being knowing since it was after World War I. It's exactly like it is now. We're just as naive and knowing today as we were then. You know, it's a... people are still stunned to find out that reality TV is scripted. It's part of us then. I'm not sure if I'll go back to that time again or not. The current work I have is not based in the 20s, but it did seem to get a few good, interesting things out of it. So. We're over on this side. Good God. Do you know there's a side over here, Amy? I didn't, yeah.
I'm struck by going back to the beginning, what you said about this artistic need to this drive to create, to be loved, to have someone read your work, and that desire you have, which is I think unique to writers, performers, to put something out there in the world and have it and be loved, and also the dichotomy of that and the fear and the anxiety. So in addition to work that you start, and then you judge either yourself or an editor or someone else judges as not good or crap, or you're putting it away, you're putting it down. Is there other work that you finish but then you decide it's too personal. You can't let it out. It's too dark. It's not going to go. Is that necessary? Is there? I picture like a secret box, but maybe now it's a it's a hard drive now, which isn't as romantic. But is that part of a creative process? Is that helpful, or is that everything more like I'm doing this? If I'm going to do it, it's going to get out there in the world.
I have a question. I noticed one of the great things about writing historical fiction, and thank you for the question, by the way, is that no one ever asks you if it's autobiographical. For yourself, do people like say, you know, The Mermaid in High School, was that you?
I mean, no, they will ask, which sometimes is funny when it's right. It's like unbelievably impossible for in the physical universe for things to happen. But it's like on some emotional level, it has to strike a chord in some way. But I guess also what I would say, too, is... one of the great joys of writing is that that first draft or that second draft or that third draft, all of it can be in that secret box where you're saying no one's going to see it. And I definitely have had stories or parts of this book where I thought, you know, I don't know if I'm going to show that to anyone. And then you can decide later, which is why, I mean, I have this kind of shocking respect for actors because an actor does that in the moment in front of people. Like, it's a very different experience, and the writer can have that experience in a solitary place and say, you know, to go as dark or as personal or as frightening or as, you know, bizarre as you can. And that usually that's the stuff that's the most universal. That's, I think, what's so striking is the stuff usually that's the most frightening to write about is the stuff for me that most people will comment and say, you know, oh, I feel that too. And that is a great feeling, you know, a great feeling of connection.
And actually, the answer, I actually am working on stuff like that right now. Doing memoirs, the next thing I'm working on. Sorry, Dad. And no, it is true. It's on a daily basis. So right now, I mean, in a way, it's for me. And there's not as much of a mask. I've mentioned this. One of the first friends I had who read Carter handed it back to me and said, I almost couldn't finish this. It was so autobiographical.
So, are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. There is that. And it's all about whether the work is going to be for you or for the world. And, it's kind of good to have like an inner circle of friends to slowly release it, figure out whether it's good for humanity or not. A couple more. Yeah.
So what are those props that you guys put up on the table?
Oh, yeah. The props.
Tarot cards, just in case things got slow.
These are Chinese prediction sticks.
Yeah. When I was in Minneapolis for my Carter Beast the Devil tour in 2001, and there was a plane lying on its side on the runway on fire when we were landing. And so I didn't tell you this part of the story. When we're landing, so there's a plane on fire, right? And there was a group of cheerleaders who were on our plane who all were like, oh, my God! But I'm sorry, this is Minneapolis. Oh, my God! This is Minneapolis, right? So, and all of them were rushing to the side of the plane when we'd landed and we're taxiing. They got out and they were like looking at this plane on fire. Everybody except their chaperone who was reading The Lovely Bones.
Very nice.
Anyway, I got in the airport, and I got this as a little talisman to keep me safe on my journey. So it comes with me every time I get in a car or a plane or anything like that. I kick around.
Like that.
So, yeah.
And then, didn't have a chance to read this, but we'll just recommend it. This is the Selected Stories of Robert Walzer, and Glenn had pointed to me a story called The Man with the Pumpkin Head, because I had a story about a man with a pumpkin head, and he was like, you are part of a lineage of stories of people with pumpkin heads, and it's a great little story. And then some maracas, which I think we should use at the end.
Yeah. Okay, right. Yeah.
The end.
Yeah.
All right.
Where did that part?
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Boujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.